Hello, my name is Jim. I blog at The Invisible Event.
I'm Moira, and I blog at Clothes and Books.
And I'm Brad, and I blog at Aw Sweet Mystery.
And we are here today to discuss Towards Zero by Agatha Christie.
We're walking through the work of the Mistress of Mystery because we're talking about books by Dame Agatha Christie. In order to be both critical and fawning, everything henceforth comes with a spoiler warning.
All right, welcome back to episode 436 of Spoiler Warning, where Brad, Moira, and I spoil books. So please make sure you've read this, otherwise you're not going to know what we're talking about, and or you're going to have a perfectly good mystery novel spoiled for you. Towards Zero is the final Superintendent Battle novel by Agatha Christie, published in 1944. This was my selection because I really love the Superintendent Battle character. As Brad is wont to say, I have developed a bit of a thing for stolid superintendents. As I've gone on, I've become less enamored of genius detectives and kind of got a bit more caught up in, you know, just these slightly boring men who just solidly work away at a problem. Although I feel Battle ends up being a little bit of an intuitive genius in this one, but we'll probably get to that when we come to discussing the solution and things like that. Moira, do you have any initial thoughts on this book that you would like to start us off with?
One thing I would say about it is that I've read it several times, and it's one of those where I think if you've read it, you would remember what the solution is. There are books where you don't remember that. This one, it's so specific, I think you would. And yet I still enjoy reading it, even though I know exactly what's going on. And I can just admire the way the clues are planted. And so for me, it's definitely top 10, I would say.
See, you say that hilariously. I remembered a couple of very clear visuals. I remember someone getting their cuff caught in somebody else's hair. And then I had this visual of someone climbing up a rope up the outside of a house. I think because around about the time I first read this, I'd recently seen The Man in the White Suit, the Ealing comedy starring Alec Guinness. And there's a fantastic scene in that where he's made this unbreakable material and he's using it to climb up the outside of a house. And there's something about that image that really stuck in my head. And apart from that, I remembered nothing at all, except that Superintendent Battle was not in it as much as I thought. Entirely different people died to who I remembered going on to die. Maybe that's just me, but I had a couple of very distinct visual memories and the details completely eluded me. Brad, what do you think about this?
I remember loving it when I read it. I thought there was something very different about it. Nowadays, I might compare it to like one of Kate Atkinson's Jackson Brody books, where a lot of disparate things happen and then they are all kind of glommed together at the end. But at the time, it just seemed like a different sort of Agatha Christie. Totally fooled me. I'm very grateful that I read these when I was young and not chronologically, because it might not fool me today if I had done it the other way. But I do really enjoy this book. And I think, like Moira, I can reread it because each time I reread it, there are different ways of looking at it. Like today, there are things I want to talk about that are beside the plot, which I think is a very good plot. Although maybe a plot that has a couple of quirks to it that we may find interesting. But I enjoy this book a lot.
Yeah, it struck me as different. There is something very different about it in terms of sort of Christie's usual output. I find it really interesting that we tend to link her to the idea of clues and what we're going to call, for the sake of ease, fair play and declaration of clues. And yet at the same time, it's very obvious from that opening chapter that she's sort of leaning very heavily into the vicissitudes of fate and of this McWhirter, Angus McWhirter, and this, you know, you're told, you know, perhaps it's almost a bit had he but known that in several months later on, he would be on top of a hill and he would prevent this life's running off and jumping into oblivion or whatever, however she phrases it. And I find that really interesting because I don't actually think this is particularly well clued. I think you can look at it and go, yeah, okay, fine, those are things that contribute to the solution, but it feels like it's much more about the fate of that man happening to be in the right place at the right time, although he's not actually in the right place at the right time, as we learn at the end. rather than about her trying to build something which is based around that steady imbrication of very subtle clues, which I think is, you know, a more sort of parallel end house ABC murders sort of form of construction.
Well, I just want to jump on what you just said, because one of the first things I wrote down as a question was for you. The books of the 30s are so clearly designed to be puzzles. And yes, you and I have had long discussions about many of them. And one of them, you had expressed a criticism, a personal criticism, regarding how long it took to get to the murder. So the question I originally had when I started reading this is, what will JJ think about the fact that the murder doesn't happen until 2/3 of the way through the book? But when you said what you just said, I realized she's doing something so different here from the more traditional puzzle mystery that I would imagine your response to this and to the lateness of the murder would be different than it was with the 30s mystery.
I don't mind a late murder in a book. What gets me is, like with something like After the Funeral, when you have a chapter that doesn't add anything to the book, that doesn't bring anything, I feel, that just slows down the narrative and just adds words purely so it makes it up to something more approaching novel length. I have no problem with a murder being delayed. Look at something like Taken at the Flood, where the first half of the novel is getting to know the people and then someone is killed halfway through. Absolutely fine with that. In the same way that you've got this lovely, I shouldn't like the beginning of this because it's these legal people having a bit of a discuss about something, and then you get all these other people and matey playing tennis, and then they're all sort of jumping ahead in time. But it's lovely because of the way in which you start to introduce the relationships that exist between everybody, which is a necessary part of the plot. My criticism of Christie in that regard in the past has just been because she put something in which actually I think the book would be better without. I maintain that opening chapter of Death on the Nile, yeah, pointless. The opening chapter of After the Funeral doesn't add anything because it's a point of view of a character that you never return to. So no, I don't mind the delay in the murder here at all. I just enjoyed the various elements of the characters that was being stirred into the pot. I really enjoyed that.
I think something that has been very interesting to me as I've reread the book, I went back and saw that I had written something about it a couple of years ago, which had very little to do with the plot, but more to do with the characters. And the question of, who is the protagonist in a mystery? I always thought of it as being the detective. Here, the detectives aren't really in it very much. Mm. And so you turn to the characters themselves and go, well, who qualifies as sort of a protagonist? And the character that strikes me is the one who kind of confronts the problem and is changed by it and grows from it and becomes a better person from it is Andrew McWhirter, who's in the book even less than the detectives. So then I asked myself, are mysteries basically just ensemble pieces with all these different people who we don't really know? And what we're trying to do is get to know who these people really are. You know, instead of having that first impression of Neville Strange or Ted Latimer or Audrey Strange, we have to go through this whole traumatic experience to get to know who they really are. And that is the experience of reading a classic mystery rather than the traditional novel approach of meeting a protagonist and following along with them. That was a thing. And I know that's sort of a tangent to the mystery because we could talk about the puzzle as well, but that was something that really interested me as I read this, these people. And how she so wonderfully in all these different segments focuses on a person. Like I really got to know Mr. Treves in the brief time that he is in this book. He opens the book, his scene at the party where he's examining all these people. And in retrospect, you understand he's wrestling with himself as to whether he should tell this story because he recognizes somebody in that party. And he's looking at all these different people and his mind process is so interesting, and then he dies. So it's a fascinating book in that way.
I think I was thinking actually again, and this is possibly in the nature of a murder story, that in any other book, Neville Strange would have been the protagonist. Yes. Without a doubt, he's quite heroic, and that moment in the middle when they say who hates you because somebody is trying to set you up. And I'm pretty sure that when I read that the first time, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, look, yeah. It's very well done. But he has all the attributes of a hero, really, a romantic hero.
No,
and
agree.
You could read it first time. You think, wow, someone's got in for him, but luckily he's going to get together back with lovely Audrey at the end, isn't he? And oh, you're going to be surprised, aren't you? The other thing, though, I would like to go back to Mr. Treves. Mr. Treves is great. He's a great character. But that story about the bow and arrow, I think she could have done better than that. They all knew each other. They were all in the same families. They all spent their childhoods together. It's not possible that they didn't know about this story, if this was true.
But he did say whoever it was changed their name. I mean, the whole point of the story with the bow and arrow is that it is the child practicing to commit a murder. So you wouldn't, I don't know, I've never committed a murder, but I don't imagine you would tell stories of the practice that you went through on the way to committing a murder. So I think even if the child's name hadn't been changed, I think Neville is still unlikely to have told that story because it was him very deliberately going out of his way to prepare for a murder.
Not quite what I mean, actually. What I mean is that they're all of a social class where they all know each other. And some of them, so for a start, Thomas and Audrey were brought up together. So it's actually possible that either of them is the child in the story, isn't it?
I remember you talking about this, Moira, and I was perturbed by it, but I was thinking, number one, this is a very British mystery. Everyone is so circumspect throughout. And I think Christie wisely does not give us a lot of information about Neville's childhood. We just know that he was put under the guardianship of Sir Matthew. And I would assume that that happened after this incident and that Sir Matthew either didn't know about it, or if he did know about it, would stolidly protect Neville in the same way that Treves says at the party, rather than saying, Mr. Strange, I recognize it's you and you better not kill anybody. He says this person was given the chance to live their life because they were a child. The farmer didn't tell because they felt the child deserved that fairness. We all feel that way about children who make mistakes. Even though Treves is aware that this kid was crazy, he performs the same act at the party. He does not unmask that person. And I would imagine that the Tressilians wouldn't either. So that and you know, Kay and Ted are way too young to have known any of these people. And I don't know that it's made clear that the Royds and Audrey grew up with Neville.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
No.
So I think he was protected from that fact by the Tressilians, even if Camilla knew. I'm not even sure Matthew would have told Camilla.
Okay. It's not ever stated anywhere. I was looking out for this when I reread it again. It is not anywhere stated that Neville Strange spent his childhood with the others. But I mean, come on, he's a child. He didn't appear from nowhere. He had parents or something. I mean, this whole story, and either they thought he did it or they didn't think he did it. But if they thought it was a really innocent thing, did he really have to change his name and move to different parents? What happened to his family? Plus, I think if you look around that table, and I don't think anybody else at that table could have been the person in that story. I don't think he was.
I mean, I would say two things on the back of that. Firstly, we don't know about his history, like Brad says. We don't know about him as a child. So it's entirely possible this may have happened at an orphanage, let's say, and he killed one of the other orphans and was then adopted or taken on or fell under Sir Matthew's stewardship or something like that. So there is an argument, yes, that they might have known, but I think there's a way that we're not going to be able to tell at all. The thing that I find ridiculous about it is he says there's this very clear identifying mark, and it's that one of his little fingers is shorter than the other little finger, which is not in any way a clear identifying mark.
And yet,
nonsense.
It is one of my favorite clues in the book.
Fair
and
enough.
Partly because of the way it is presented. We are shown Mary Alden's lock of white hair about seven times.
Yeah.
Mr. Treves and 50 other people say that Ted Latimer has such an oddly shaped skull. We are told, Audrey tells us 80 times, please pay no attention to my rummy ear. And Thomas Royd is limping along with his deformed arm. But the story about the finger is woven beautifully into the early part of the book at a dinner party. It's Christie at her best. And the TV movie, which we don't even have to discuss, puts it later after Mr. Cheese has died. And not only does Kay point it out and sort of point at Neville and say, you're weird, you have a weird deformity, but Greg Wise, who plays Neville, has a long finger that goes up to like his eyebrow. It's the longest little finger I've ever seen in my life. It's creepy. It's like one of those floppy alien hands in one of those movies, you know? So they do it all wrong there, but she does it so well. So I will accept your opinions that it's silly. I don't understand how Mr. Treves could see the finger, except maybe he saw it when the hand got caught in the...
Not again. Here. Again, I think we're reaching to provide an explanation that the book does not provide. Right.
It may be a weakness, but it's one that I love. And so I will forgive her for it.
I did remember thinking, because I couldn't quite remember who the killer was. And I did remember thinking, well, the others have these weird peculiarities, but I couldn't remember what Neville's peculiarity could possibly be. So she absolutely got it past me. I won't deny that at all. I failed to remember that was a peculiarity of his, despite having read that scene. But it's also nonsense. I don't believe that would be this deeply telling mark of Cain. I don't buy that for a second.
But the thing that I really like about the story that I think is so effective is that Christie doesn't use insanity very often, but she usually uses it very effectively. I'm thinking of And Then There Were None and Murder Is Easy as two other examples where you are told right from the start, pretty much, that someone is crazy in this book. And then you have to watch all these people and look for signs of it. And so I did that very carefully when I read this book each time. And especially now, you're seeing Mary Alden's servility combating with her desire for independence. You see Thomas Roy being defeated in love. You see how kind and wonderful Neville is in every circumstance. You see Audrey, and they keep saying, is Audrey crazy? I think Audrey might be crazy. She seems a little mad, don't you think? So you watch all these behaviors and you try to apply them to that wonderful passage early on when you are actually sitting with the murderer in a room as they plot their crime, which is a beautiful passage. And it sets you up to look for that in each character, which I think is very good. The details of the Bow and Arrow story and some of the problems may be problematic, but I do think that in the larger sense, she accomplishes her purpose really well there.
The other thing I want to say ever so quickly about the Bow and Arrow story is the line is, personally, I'm of the opinion that it was a particularly ingenious murder, a murder committed by a child and planned down to every detail beforehand. Part of me wonders if this is slightly foreshadowing a novel in which Christie will have a murder committed by a child, which is, we know, planned down to every single detail beforehand. Is this sort of like the roots of that, do we think, of her going, oh, maybe I could have a murder that is actually planned out meticulously and executed by a child? Or am I just seeing stuff that isn't there?
It's a good take on it, because it's not that long afterwards, is it?
No,
which we won't go any further with that. I hadn't thought of that, but yes. You can see her taking that up, can't you?
Mm.
And maybe thinking of a few better details than
yes,
I consider yes. to be in this one. To me, that, just to go back to it one last time, that thing, it was slightly sketchy. It was as if she had what is a great idea, that this guy is going to tell a story, the story will mean something to somebody, and that he's going to have a way of identifying them. But to me, each of those things wasn't quite worked out properly. Mm. She should have had a better thing.
Well, it's not unlike, is it, what's the one you love, Brad? A Caribbean Mystery, where someone sees something and recognizes something and gives a look and then nothing more is said and then they die mysteriously. Or not Murder in Mesopotamia. What's the other one where they're on the archaeological dig and it's the prison warden?
Oh, Appointment with Death.
Appointment with Death. That same sort of thing where they go, I never forget her face. And then they die mysteriously not too long afterwards. It's a motif that she's quite fond of.
Well, I think she does like to play with this concept of that murder impulse beginning in childhood. I start to think of all the characters who we're told were odd children. They are revealed as murderers and we're told they were odd children or they were difficult children. Not always mad, but they had a moral screw loose. So that is, I think, a very interesting thing. It certainly could be the basis for that later case. But when you've examined both those cases, you do see this sort of total lack of moral compunction. At the end, Battle says to Neville, if anybody flicks you on the raw, you feel they could die, right? It doesn't matter. Whatever you need, you know, whatever minor affront must be met with the most extreme punishment. That's the behavior of a child. And in that sense, Neville never grew up.
One of the things I'm very interested in that I was particularly impressed with rereading it in After a Gap is how well she does this revelation by Audrey at the end that she's frightened all the time, that she knows that there's something wrong with this man, but she doesn't know what it is. And I would say that nowadays we're much more familiar with that whole idea. It's the gaslighting, it's coercive control, which has recently been identified and recognized as a legal issue, that somebody can frighten somebody to a quite extraordinary extent without ever performing violence, should we say, or forcing them or do something or stopping them from doing something. But it is control and it is serious. And I think her description of that bit at the end where Audrey said, I was just always frightened that I didn't know why, and I knew he was going to do something. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know how he was going to do it. It's absolutely chilling, but also very, very modern, I think. I mean, it's the kind of thing you would expect in one of these modern toxic marriage thrillers. I think she's way ahead of her time with that.
This is why I compare this book to a typical puzzle book. And I just think it's so strong as a novel with murder that it's okay if some of the puzzle stuff isn't quite as effective. The whole through line of Audrey being frozen through most of the book. And she's frozen because in her position as a woman, a formerly married woman, she has no sense of her own power to say, this man frightened me. I don't want to spend time with him. He terrorized me. She can't do that. No one will believe her. They'll believe Neville. And that is a case of something that's going on to this day. Christy does exactly what you just said beautifully. But then she forgets to tell us till the very end that Audrey left Neville, not the other way around, which I think she's holding forth some important motive information till the very end. As a puzzle, I find that a little suspect, but it doesn't really matter because the storyline between the relationship of Audrey and Neville is so beautifully rendered. All his kindness, all his solicitude, his come into the back and let's talk a little bit. You will always be my wife, takes on this terrifying aspect at the end when you finally understand what it all really means. That's so well done that I kind of forgive her for the fact that it takes Thomas coming in saying, wait a minute, on page 240, wait a minute, she doesn't have a motive. It's the other way around, man. Did you tell them that? I thought that's a little bit of a cheat.
I don't know. I thought that was a genuine surprise again the first time I read it. And I thought, oh yeah, and now I see it. I see why, for example, she wouldn't take any money from him. It made so much more sense. And also him pretending to be really kind about it. But obviously, what he's actually doing is preserving face. He doesn't like the idea that she's left him. It's much more rewarding for him to believe that he left her, and so he goes along with it. And the fact that it's secret that nobody knows, I thought that was fair play.
Yeah, and it all makes sense afterwards that Thomas does not declare his love, and that at that scene at the beach, he says, I've known the truth, I've always known the truth. And we don't understand until the end what that truth is, which is she loved Adrian, she was going off with Adrian, that he never stood a chance, and neither really did Neville. So they just don't say it out loud because British people don't say these things out loud until the end of a mystery.
Yeah. And it is that scene on the beach. Again, it's very clever. You don't notice it when you first read it, but when you read it again, you think, oh, right, he's saying to her, yeah, I know that thing that nobody else knows.
That scene on the beach is wonderful, by the way. I love that scene on the beach. We see the bitterness in Mary Alden. We see Ted Latimer in a new light when he sits down with Mary and says, you all hate me. Mm-hmm. And we realize he's not just a gigolo. He's a 20-something man thrust in with all these middle-aged people, just like Kay is, and going, my whole life has been lost and I don't know why. Kay and I were fine. And the reason was that Neville needed a beard, a shill, to guide him toward this plot. Nobody understands that till the very end. So Ted was wronged. We think of him as a lounge lizard, but he wasn't. He was this young guy who loved this young girl, and he was wronged. And I think that flip, that reversal, is beautifully rendered. And clued in the beach.
See, I think this comes back to what you're saying about who is the main character in a mystery. I don't think it matters who the main character in a mystery is, because you get something like, I'm just trying to think, like The 1230 from Croydon by Freeman Wills Crofts, where ostensibly the main character is the murderer, because the first 23 chapters are spent following the murderer and the last three chapters are spent following the detective. No one's going to argue that Joseph French is the main character in that book. He's barely in it. But I think it's not so much whether the main character or who the main character is. I find for a mystery, what I want in the characters is not to worry about who the focus of it is, but to worry about whether I find it believable that these people would behave in the way that they do, and to find something in them as people that it's possible to connect to. This is one of the things, in spite of his many flaws, this is one of the things I really love about the work of Anthony Barclay, and that you put down an Anthony Barclay book and you can say, here is an action that would be attributable to a particular character, or here is an action that there's no way in hell that someone's going to do. And I think Christie does that very well as we get through the 30s. I think you're right, the 30s are more kind of puzzle focused. And as we get into the 40s and they start to become more populated by actual real people, and you're encouraged more to see the seeds of that insanity, or to see the seeds of that dissatisfaction sown, I think as long as I can believe in the people, I don't really mind about who the main character is going to be. And that's what I didn't appreciate first time around, because as I have said before, somewhere else, possibly in the previous episode of this podcast, I was reading this very excited to be reading a Superintendent Battle book. I wanted to read more of Superintendent Battle, and he's barely bloody in it. And so I was flipping through all this stuff going, oh, where's Battle? Get to the halfway point. Then he suddenly shows up. And then there's a bit of hasty construction of cluing, which I think is dodgy at best, but we'll get to that. And I was just annoyed that who I wanted to be the main character was hardly in the book, although ostensibly the detective, as you say, Brad, possibly should be the main character. This time around, what I liked was the fact that, yeah, it doesn't really matter that the character shifts. I mean, Neville probably is the main character in this book, and that's weird because it's not an inverted mystery. We're not privy to a lot of what's going on in Neville's head until we retrospectively put it together at the end. But he is very believable, and the situations and the relationships between these people is very believable. And I find that probably more important than whether somebody has X proportion of the book to themselves to be able to point to as the lead.
Oh, absolutely. And when you think of, let's just, Christie's books in the 40s, Poirot is barely in Sad Cypress. Miss Marple is barely in Moving Finger. Poirot is barely in The Hollow. People criticize these things all the time, saying, well, why did she even include these detectives when they're not in it that much? As if they are expecting the detective figure to drive the story home. Yeah. But I do think what you're saying is so insightful, because a mystery can allow us to view stories from a variety of different ways. The problem of The Wire Cage has Dr. Fell as a distant antagonistic figure, mm-hmm. while we're focused on a young couple trying to save themselves from a false accusation, unless she did do it. He doesn't know, but he's trying because he loves her to save this girl, and it's all about them. And that's not how Carr always tells his stories, but Carr and Christie and Brand, they feel that wide circle of people, the different factions, the murderer, the victims, the suspects, the detective, all have a story to tell. And that's particularly true, I think, as we're getting into the 40s and we're less about the consulting detective and they come to the office at the beginning and they present their problem. And a lot of writers did that over and over and over and over and over again. Mm. But a mystery allows a little bit more flexibility that way.
Something like The Hound of the Baskervilles being told it's a Sherlock Holmes novel and he's barely bloody in it. So how can it be a Sherlock Holmes novel? Who is the main character of The Hound of the Baskervilles? Probably the dog, and the dog's barely in it. You know, so it's one of these things that I think you come to realize. I was just first time around, I wanted more battle because I knew there was no more battle after this until, obviously, somebody starts writing battle continuation novels, which I'm sure we'll all look forward to.
And he's really lovely here.
Yeah.
He's really good here because you see how he's grown and changed since he met Hercule Poirot, since he got older and is probably on the verge of retirement, although he has a teenage daughter. They keep referring to him as the elderly man, but he has a teenage daughter. So unless he had her when he was in his mid to late 50s, I would say he's still probably 50, you know, but...
Yeah, but don't forget, I mean, by the time you're a 30-year-old woman, if you're unmarried, you're practically a crone, aren't you, in the 1930s and 40s? So, I mean, it's a fairly unsparing era to be anything more than 23 and unmarried. Shall we talk about some of the clues then? Because, Moira, you said you like the clues. I find the cluing a little bit lacking and suspicious, and Brad always sides against me, so Brad also really likes the clues. I think we can be reasonably sure about that. Moira, tell us what you like about the clues in this.
Okay, so there were two clues that I particularly liked. One was the backhand that they planted nicely, that Neville has a very strong backhand, which means that he could go and kill her. But the way that that was put in amongst the tennis, I thought was very good. Another one that I really liked was the windows. So kind of battle is looking at the windows and the pole that's used to open the windows, and he's looking. And again, I think if you were reading it for the first time, you would be convinced he's wondering whether somebody could have got in through the windows. We're not getting the fact that the pole can be used to trip the wires from outside. And they were two particular clues that I liked very much.
Brad.
I'm on your side, Jim.
Yeah, really? Good heavens.
I love the clues that she just mentioned. I think they're great. I think one of the problems with the cluing is that when McWhirter comes back in, everything he comes up with is actually total guesswork.
Yeah.
And he pretends it's all clued, but yeah, it was all a big lie, and the rope is a lucky break and all of that. That's a little problematic for me. So I kind of I stand between you both, I think. I think some of the cluing toward that battle comes across that leads him eventually to Neville is great. I think what McWhirter does is a completely different kettle of fish. And speaking of fish, that whole thing about the, you know, we're in the billiard room and Neville says, the drains smell like rotting fish. I wonder why. Because the suit that you stuffed under a rock when you swam across the bay, climbed naked up the wall, killed a woman, did all the things you did, came back down the cliff, swam across the bay, and put that suit back on, and Ted Latimer doesn't notice a thing about you. You are completely beautifully coiffed and gelled, and you smell just a little bit of rotting fish. And I also think that the coincidence, which I never like, of Neville saying, I'm going to get this suit clean, let me look on the hotel register and pick a name. Oh, I'll pick Andrew McWhirter as the name. It's like, you can call that rotten bad luck, but he's had enough rotten bad luck with the other things, with Mr. Treves showing up and finding this child here in the house. Coincidence plays a little bit too much of a part here.
Yeah.
So there are things that I do feel I'm probably siding more with you on, Jim, regarding the cluing here.
Good heavens.
I do love the two clues that Moira mentioned. I think they're brilliantly put there and serve the plot well.
The backhand clue is very good. It's very, very good. I really like that. I did have to look up a niblick, and I can't believe for a second that you would mistake the niblick as the thing that would have actually caused the wounds on the head, given that this is 1944. You know, we're told it's some sort of sphere from the end of a fender that is screwed into a tennis handle, whereas a niblick is effectively a nine iron. This weapon shape is not the same as the wound shape, so I don't believe that for a second. But I like the way in which they fold it in with the tennis. I think that's really, really good. I find the dusty room in which, obviously, Neville has gone into the room, got the rope, tied it to something, because as we all know, houses are just full of stuff that you can tie a rope of untold length to then climb down the outside of a house and the cliff that house is on top of. But we're told the room is dusty and no one's been in there and nothing's been touched, except there's this sopping wet rope in the corner. So obviously he's gone in while sopping wet to, while dry to pick up the rope and while sopping wet to replace the rope, potentially. I find that a little bit, I don't know. I think, I can't remember whether it's Battle or Christie, but someone tells us, oh, well, obviously nobody had been in that room for any length of time. Everything was covered in dust. And you're like, well, yeah, but there would be footprints or there would be something. I also find the length of the rope, somehow I feel I would like that to be in there. If we're supposed to deduce that you can climb down the outside of the house and down the cliff using that rope, I'd like to know what it's tied to. I'd like to know how long it is, but I think that might just be, I don't know how you do that, but I mean, there's a way to do everything, right? I wrote a novel called The Red Death Murders, available at Amazon. You should definitely buy it if you haven't already. And there are definitely clues in that, which I was just like, I have no idea how I'm going to get this in. But you always find a way. I believe that any clue that's worth including in your solution can be got in with the right sentence in the right place.
The problem I have with the Niblick, if we're imagining Neville sitting in that room, scratching out this plot for murder, and he goes, okay, I will take a tennis racket. I will saw off the top. I will take one of the fenders out of the room Audrey will be sleeping in. I will unscrew it, screw it into the top. I will kill her with that. Then I will unscrew it, wipe it except for a little blood, screw it back in, put the tennis racket back on, bandage that. Then I will take my Niblick and I will dip it in her blood so that it looks like someone's trying to incriminate me. Okay. But if we are trying to imagine Audrey sitting in that room, writing that out, why wouldn't she just say, and I'll use Neville's Niblick to incriminate him? Why would she do the whole tennis racket thing? It seems like an awful lot of work. And I'm still not sure how Neville got all of that done and swam back and put on his suit and went to play billiards with Ted Latimer.
But no, the timeline doesn't work. In Audrey's defense, she might not have known that he was going to bring golf clubs, right? Because as far as Audrey knows, Neville's going to be there with his new wife. And so it could be that she's planned to put something with Neville's fingerprints somewhere in the room. Although we are told that insane mind has thought out every single possible permutation and reaction. But I can see Audrey going, oh, well, there will be something somewhere that will have Neville's fingerprints on that I will be able to plant to incriminate him. I don't have so much of a problem with that.
And I've always thought this sort of conforms along with Five Little Pigs and The Hollow, with that murder triangle, that husband, wife, lover situation, where you've got Neville Strange is Archie Christie. I'm saying this in the most lighthearted sense, folks, so don't come at me. Archie Christie, the great athlete, very gorgeous, very likable, but with this dark streak of like cheating on his wife. And then there's the wife who wasn't quite as athletic, although Christie did try to play golf with him. And the lover who became the other wife, who Nancy Neal was an inveterate golfer. They really kind of bonded on the golf course. So there's all that kind of surface biography there that can kind of, again, sort of put some people on their guard about Neville, and others will feel more like, this is the kind of man we all like we all like Archie Christie.
Yeah, and it comes up a few times, I think, in Christie about a man being stolen away by a woman who either is or isn't good at games, you know, that if a man's good at games, perhaps the wife should try to share that a bit. It's in one of the Mr. Parker Pyne investigate stories, I think, but I think maybe in another book as well.
I do think it's interesting to compare this with Five Little Pigs, which I feel we can talk a little bit about because we've spoiled it before. And that is that you've got this triangle of the woman, the younger woman, stealing the husband away from the wife. Again, there are layers to that are very different. But what I think is very interesting in the difference between that trio is that Caroline Crail fights. She's yelling and screaming about that. She's like, you know, I'll kill you before I'll let you leave her. In this one, it's not the case. Audrey doesn't say anything. We're not given much information about it, but we're never given a sense that she fought to keep him. She's very reticent. She's very quiet. She's very kind to Kay. And I think that, you know, it's a way, own way could be kind of a clue that all is not as it seems. You know, there's a difference. There's a different nature in every triangle that she introduces. And I think that's one of her strengths, that she can take that same basic situation that was so traumatic for her in 1926 and reintroduce it over and over again, from Triangle at Rhodes through Death on the Nile, through Evil Under the Sun, through Sad Cyber. Every single one of the books that focuses on a triangle treats it differently and manages to mine a great deal of mystery gold out of it, not just drama, but switches around the mystery beautifully. It'll happen again in The Hollow in a completely different way, which I just think is part of her greatness.
It's a really good perception.
It's a more interesting take on that whole era of her life than the thing that people seem to dwell on, which is, oh, she disappeared for 11 days. Actually, there's a far more, whether it's pervasive, I'm not sure if that's quite the word I want, but there's definitely something with Christie and love triangles and husbands who are not necessarily unfaithful, but husbands who are married twice, shall we say, and the first wife is still alive, or they're in the process of leaving their wife, or they get caught up in something like in Evil Under the Sun. That is a far, far, far more interesting thing to come out of that period of Christie's life through her fiction than just what seems to be dwelt on by everybody, which is, Agatha Christie. Did you know Agatha Christie? 11 days. Do you know Agatha Christie disappeared for 11 days? I've written a book about Agatha Christie. Oh, is it when she disappeared? It's when she disappeared for 11 days. Oh, look, there's a new book coming out about Agatha Christie. It's based on the 11 days. I've written this book where Agatha Christie, when she disappeared for 11 days, I think she went and committed a crime in those 11 days. Yeah, you and everybody else. Like, let's try and do something a bit more.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. It's a flashy symptom of a much more interesting situation of the human condition. Three people navigating through a lot of pain. And what happened in those 11 days is a brief flash that was symptomatic of all of that pain and all of what was going on. And what I always find admirable and amazing about artists is that they can mine that pain for creative content over and over and over again. I'm sure that Christie was able to find her way past it. She married again, a very happy marriage. She had her family, she had her houses, she had her career. And who knows how much that sparked her every time she dealt with that situation. But she did it over and over again through Elephants Can Remember. You know, she does it right up to the end. So she knew when she had some literary gold there. And she used it. Good for her.
You might almost say that she was like a child who, by a tightly clenched hand over a treasure, calls attention to what it wants to hide, wouldn't you?
What's that?
That's a line from chapter two in this. No. It's a line I particularly liked in chapter two and highlighted. Because it's she keeps coming back to it. I think you're right. I think it is something which holds a particular fascination for her. And whether it's her, whether she's trying to make sense of something or whether she just recognizes the sheer diversity of possibilities that it represents, because automatically you hear of a love triangle and you assume that's going to be happy for two people and unhappy for a third. And straight away, there's a dynamic there that you can exploit. I mean, even if it's not something that you've lived through, you know, as a horrific, wounding life event, you can still look at that as someone who writes supposedly misdirecting fiction and be like, well, look, here's the thing, where obviously these two people are happy and this one person isn't going to be happy about it, and then immediately play around with that, immediately twist that so that the people, as she has done, the people who shouldn't be happy are, and the people who are happy shouldn't be, and etc. There's so much diversity just in that one simple setup, and it makes you appreciate how she was able to write 80 books coming up with more or less, you know, the same five or six or seven tricks or principles or conceits and just slightly rejuggling. I mean, okay, fine, there's some repetition of plots in there, but it shows a tremendous fecundity of imagination, if nothing else.
I do think it's interesting that this group of people would allow this group of people to hang out together for a week. You know, for Camilla to allow both the wives to be there, for everyone to be comfortable enough with Ted Latimer hanging out. it's a strange kind of gathering. It doesn't feel as closed circles do, because it seems like anybody who could rub somebody else the wrong way has come together. Thomas Royd's longing for Audrey, Audrey's weird feelings about what happened, Kay's hatred of Audrey, Ted's lust for Kay, Neville's, you know, what is going on? Why are these people together? Why doesn't Camilla said, you all have to come at a different time. I'm not going to accept this. I will not have unpleasantness in my last few years of my beautiful home. But they do. I don't know if you consider that a problem or just the nature of mysteries, but it's a strange thing that this is allowed to happen. And they spend a lot of time going, well, it was Neville's idea. No, it was Audrey's idea. Well, it was Neville's idea. It's really not up to Neville or Audrey. It's up to Camilla, who didn't want it in the first place. Why does she allow this?
It's, I mean, they do go into it, into her feelings about it. And then she says eventually, well, I suppose I will accept it. I'm not moving Audrey, and okay, all right, then if they must, they must. I think she does accept that. She does try to provide a solution, because obviously if she doesn't happen, she hasn't got a plot. But I feel that they go into Lady Tressilian's feelings about it sufficiently for me. Well, shall I say that?
Yeah, it didn't bother me so much. I suppose as far as Camilla is concerned, Neville's first wife has said, yeah, I'm perfectly happy meeting Neville's second wife, and I think we should probably try and be friends. And I imagine there's a bit of, because she's effectively Neville's mother by adoption, there's a bit of that sort of willing to accept that. Obviously, Camilla still has very positive relations with Audrey, otherwise Audrey wouldn't be there in September every single year. And so there's a bit of wanting people to get on. There's a certain blindness to it. I mean, she doesn't necessarily know that Ted Latimer is going to turn up and that Ted and Kay have the relationship that they do. But it didn't bother me so much. At the same time, yeah, I think you're right. I think there comes a point where you've got to go, well, this stuff's just going to happen. Otherwise, there isn't a plot. You know, it's a bit like, why does everybody gather at a funeral and then argue and then all be bitter about everything? Or why do patriarchs tell everybody that their lawyer has been called and they'll be coming in the morning and they're going to alter their will and ensure that nothing is the way it was? If you don't allow for a certain amount of artifice, then you're not going to have your plot. And as I said before, as long as I find it compelling from a character perspective, and I think as well, potentially Camilla's out of the way most of the time because she's in her lift, she's up in the bed. So potentially she's just like, well, if they want to come and use my house, I'm not going to be around to see it anyway. It doesn't bother me. If all Camilla did was carp on about how unhappy she was about it, then yeah, you would sit down and go, well, why in the hell have you allowed it to happen? Regardless of Neville saying Audrey's fine with it, why would you allow it to happen if you were that unhappy? I'm with Moira on this. I think it's covered enough that it's not problematic for me, certainly.
Also, it does create a bit of the atmosphere of the book, which is very good, I think, about, well, who did suggest this? That kind of weird, slightly weird thing about, well, where did it come from? Is somebody lying here? And I thought actually it was quite convincing, actually, because Camilla obviously did get persuaded, possibly against her better judgment, and then really regrets it and says, why did I ever let them all come into the house? And actually, that just seemed really realistic. That's exactly what people do in real life, isn't it? That they let those things happen and then get really annoyed about it. I think there's no evidence that she had to see Kay at all, is there? I mean, she doesn't come out of her room, is that right?
As far as I'm aware.
So she can see Audrey and she can see Neville. She doesn't have to see Kay or Ted, because she just summons people up and that's that.
I'm sure she came up to her room to say hello, but that's not in the book. It is in that adaptation, but it isn't in the book. So, okay. So one of my favorite moments in the book happens at the end when Battle arrests Audrey and Neville sprang forward. Audrey, don't say anything. Don't speak at all. She smiled at him. But why not, Neville? It's all true. And I'm so tired. Leech drew a deep breath. Well, that was that. Mad as a hatter, of course, but it would save a lot of worry. He wondered what had happened to his uncle. The old boy was looking as though he had seen a ghost, staring at the poor, demented creature as though he couldn't believe his eyes. Christy does a lot of these scenes in her books where somebody sees the truth and they just sort of stare ahead. Poirot does it, Miss Marple does it. Oh, what a fool I've been, that kind of thing. And it brings back the whole story that happened way long ago with his daughter, Sylvia. And I do love that early section where these disparate situations occur that then all get brought together at the end, that Sylvia's false confession will remind Battle of what happens with Audrey. And although there's the limitations of a mystery where Christie can't delve quite as deeply into this, I do think it's really interesting that you've got Neville making this plan where he's looking at every contingency going, here's what's going to happen bit by bit. Here's alternative plan. If A falls through, I can do B, that kind of thing. And he's mapped out how he's going to get everyone together and how he's going to kill Camilla and frame Audrey over the course of a year. Juxtapose against the hands of fate, which does the exact same thing. It throws other things out. Andrew McWhirter throws himself off the cliff. Neville couldn't know that. He's saved by a twist of fate and comes back. All of that is going to work against Neville. Battle is going to have to deal with his daughter's confession. That will work against Neville. These are things that also happen over the course of a year that intertwine with the best laid plans of mice and men. And I think it's oft ganga glee or something like that. They go wrong because fate doesn't let you get what you want. You can't always get what you want, even if you plan really, really carefully for that vacation or that murder. And I just think it's done very well. And maybe it could have been done a little more deeply in a novel. I think some novels do the same idea, but within the confines of a mystery where we're really more plot centered, it works beautifully.
Do you think that's the point then at which Battle realizes the truth, when Audrey confesses and it isn't actually true? Because that's something I was trying to work out, because I sort of got the impression when he's first looking around the house and they make the point about the window and the pole and the burglar screw. And I think he says something about, oh yeah, no, I wasn't thinking so much about somebody coming in through the window, whereas I took the implication at times, I mean, oh, you're thinking of someone going out through the window, which is obviously what Neville does after he commits the murder. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting that he straight away makes that connection with the window being how somebody got in or got out to commit the murder. And this goes back to my point about something being psychologically compelling. One of the most important moments for me where that is concerned is when the detective realizes the truth and trying to establish the clue or the implication or the delineation of events, at which the detective goes, oh, crikey, I see it all now. And that was something I'd forgotten about, but I was like, it seemed really odd to me that Battle, in my interpretation of it, just seems to immediately be onto something about that window. But Moira, as you quite rightly said, it's probably more him thinking about the pole and the ringing of the bell than somebody going in and out of the window. So are you suggesting, Brad, that Battle's moment of realization of the truth is the arrest of Audrey? He genuinely believes Audrey is guilty, and then she confesses and he has that flashback to his daughter.
I think he is clear when that happens that Audrey is innocent. I'm not sure that gives him the whole truth. He's never felt too happy about the whole framing of Neville and all of that. So he's uncomfortable with everything. But I do think that seeing that look on her face makes it clear to him that Audrey did not kill her. I do think that these moments that you talk about in mysteries are purposefully made oblique, because no author wants to give the whole game away at that point. There's a moment in an earlier novel, One, Two, Buckle My Shoe, and I'm not spoiling anything, but Poirot is in church and he is listening to the sermon and the preacher saying something about, for thou hast laid a snare against me and I have nearly fallen into it. And Poirot leaps up in church and realizes that he has nearly fallen into the killer's trap. Mm. He's been led astray. But there's nothing about that moment that gives us any information as to who the killer is. So here, I think Christie does another good job where Leach, we see it from Leach's point of view. He was not privy to the situation with Sylvia. He doesn't know why the man is making that look. But if we have been reading Christie for a long time, we know that look means something. When the detective goes, ha, 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 you know, something's up. Or if they say, "Oh, but of course," or "What an imbecile I have been," or "Oh, I've been very foolish," they are letting us know that something has just happened. In the 30s, she loved to do that with Hastings. "Hastings, you have just given me the clue I need, you beautiful man." And we know Hastings knows nothing. So it's the obfuscation of that moment that is as important to the author. And so that would probably make it difficult for you to go, "Can I trace this back to something?" But if we look at it in hindsight, then we're supposed to understand, oh yeah, he saw the look. It was the same look that Sylvia gave. So he's starting there from the basis that Audrey is not the killer. And if she's not the killer, then all of this stuff is a frame up too. And are there really two frame ups? And then he can start putting it together. Because it's really hard for me to embrace the idea that he's totally lost until McWhorter comes in and lies and says he saw Neville climbing up the cliff, because nobody did. And that's just a lie based on a guess, based on a piece of damp rope that he found. McWhorter really shouldn't have that information. In the play, it's all Thomas Royd. Well, in one of the plays, in another play, it's McWhorter, but in one of the plays, it's Thomas Royd, who is on the scene and can see what's been going on, and he becomes the detective. So Christie's playing around with this story a lot in her different versions of it. And I find it hard, again, to accept McWhorter in that role, because everything is pretty much lucky guesswork based on the fact that he has all of a sudden fallen in love with this woman. And says to her at the end, to the horror of every 21st, 22nd century man and woman, "Last time I had my hands on you, you felt like a bird struggling to escape. You'll never escape now." Here she goes again with some crazy guy, some metal Scotsman.
Absolutely.
Take her to South America and keep her as a prisoner on his ranch.
We'll never see her again, will we?
We won't. We won't. Poor Audrey. Come on, Audrey. Get it together. Go back with Thomas Royd.
They always choose the same man over and over, you know. I'd like to say that Angus McWhorter, there's a character in Problem of the Wire Cage called Angus McWhorter. He's the odd job man. There is, yeah. Yeah.
That's hilarious. I've just read Murder in the Basement by Anthony Barclay. And there's a character in that called Wargrave. And I was sat through it the whole time going, why the bloody hell is Wargrave ringing so many bells? Of course, it's because of... And then there were none.
There were none, yeah.
And I was just... Yeah, you get these weird things with these names. It's insane. There should be almost infinite capacity for you to choose any name at all, and yet the same ones keep turning up again and again and again. It seems a little bit ridiculous.
But yeah. Anyway.
So
I'd just like to say one thing, actually, one further thing, which is I think at the end, when they're describing how Neville committed the crime, they say, oh, he was really good at mountain climbing, which is obviously relevant. But I don't think it's mentioned anywhere else in the book. It does say, you know, he's a sportsman, he plays tennis, he plays golf. But I think she should have just dropped that in. It would have been very easy to pile on the description of him as the perfect Englishman who likes to do golf, tennis, and mountain climbing. That's all that would have been necessary. She does not.
It's mentioned
as a given later on, but it's not. Fair. I don't think it's.
I think I would like it more if McWhorter had actually seen Neville climbing the rope. I don't know why, but I think he's set up as such this fateful figure at the very start of the first chapter. I love the idea of him both saving Audrey as she's about to hurl herself over the cliff, and he also happens to have been in the correct place to have seen, and then makes the connection that was not. I don't see why he couldn't have seen it. There's a nice circularity to that. I mean, this is not the first time that Christie has had someone lie about what is seen in order to catch a killer in a confession. She did this in another book, and I didn't like it then either. And
well, nobody loves that kind of thing. I think there are some additional details in that situation, like the hypodermic mark that says I was poisoned on Mrs. Lorimer's arm. But there, you know, there are other things. But yes, that seems very deus ex machina and is thus never satisfying in a classic mystery.
I don't understand why they couldn't, because then to a certain extent, it would make McWhirter the main character, because he is the one to come along and to unpick all of it. He saves Audrey's life when she's about to hurl herself over the cliff. And he's the one to unpick the scheme, because he would have seen somebody climbing up the rope, and then they go to battle and battle goes well. It obviously had to be a man. Well, it obviously had to be a man, but it had to be a man. And it couldn't have been Royd because of his gammy arm. And so therefore it's Neville. Like, I don't know, a bit of me would have preferred that. That feels more like a design behind McWhirter being fate, where all of Neville's...
Nurse says to him at the beginning, you might be going to save someone. You see, I'm the opposite. I really like that. I like that. It's just an extra little bit at the end when he says, could I really have seen it that night? Or could you really have seen it that night? Mm. No, you couldn't.
Well, again, I think it's...
Don't object to it at all.
No, it's okay. 40. It's 40s romantic melodrama too. It's Mary Westmacott, you know, the woman rushing off to kill herself and the man rescues her, and it sort of shifts him from a total emotional disconnect with the world to having a goal, having something worth living for, and he doesn't even understand it at first, and he kind of... I just think, like you, that he's maybe in it too little for me to really care too much about what's happening to him.
Sure.
I saw at the beginning, and then he comes at the very, very, very last minute. And I'd like to see a little bit more of him. But again, it's romantic melodrama. In that, the TV adaptation that we won't talk about, they do one very interesting thing with her suicide attempt. McWhirter has cut from the screenplay. He's not in the story at all. So when she runs off to kill herself, it's Neville who saves her. And he says, you can't. He holds her in his arms and says, you can't do it. And the reason he does that, as we realize in the end, is that he doesn't want her to get the easy way out. He wants her to be on trial, to suffer and to hang. In that way, he's very much like the killer in Five Little Pigs, who is reveling in the suffering of the person on trial, the woman on trial, and then will be dead after that, you know, emotionally gone. There's nothing left because all they've got is their hate. But they don't do that in the book. In the book, it's McWhirter and it's romance. It's romance, and I accept that. I did at the time. I just think it is a little convenient that he's there the right time, the right place, but that he can guess what happened and use that guess to solve the murder.
Yeah.
And force a confession. And everything works out at the end so that he can fly her off in his cage to South
America. to be chopped up and stored in a series of freezers somewhere in the colonies. Yeah, poor woman.
Right,
poor.
Right.
Well, I mean, we all know that as soon as you see a damp rope, it's been used by someone to climb down the outside of a house on a wet night. I mean, it's the only way rope gets wet.
Well, he walked in and said, I want a rope. Why would he do that? He guessed that. There must be a rope somewhere.
Yep.
And then knock on the door. Miss Alden, can we look around for a rope, please? Oh, good. And it's wet. And the man who spent, an hour and a half carefully figuring out everything, decided to just dump the rope, in a storeroom. Come on, dude. Think, Neville. All right.
Anything else about this that we feel the need? I don't have any other notes that are worth talking about. The one thing I do have that is probably not worth talking about is I absolutely love the bit written from the perspective of the dog, where he gets all indignant that he has to have the smell of dead fish washed off of him. It just reminded me a bit of Buster in the Five Find Outers novels by Enid Blyton, which it's just a dog. Anything with a dog in typically makes me happy, with the exception of Cujo. But I just enjoyed that. Is anything else, any other minor points anybody wants to bring up?
And the dog even gets to think through things, because we always get the dog's point of view in a Christie novel.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've got to go with a clothes thing, which is that I just love it that in the midst of all this, so Audrey and Kay are at daggers drawn, at the throats virtually. Kay is physically attacking her at some point and going mad. But at one point, Kay and they need morning clothes. So they go off together in the car to the local town to go shopping for clothes. This couple who hate each other. And I love that. The priorities, obviously, that getting the morning clothes is more important than anything else. Yeah. I've got to find a black dress to wear.
And I just want to say that, you know, I'm in the middle right now on my blog site of my rebranding project. I'm rereading all the books of Christiana Brand and actually get to read one of them for the first time. And I just did Green for Danger, which was published the same year. Green for Danger is rich with the setting of war in a wartime hospital with the bombs dropping. And this book, which was published in 1944, but according to Laura Thompson, was written in 1941 when there was war going on, is completely absenting the war from the circumstances. I think Christy made a very conscious effort through most of the war to not bring it up, to let her books be a distraction from the war. After the war, she wrote a lot of post-war novels that were about England post-war, and they're fascinating in that regard. But most of the time, with very few exceptions, NRM.
NRM. I think it's the only one. I think NRM is the only one that deals with the war.
Taken at the Flood, or is that post-war?
Post-war. Okay. And it's very much like A Murder Is Announced. It's about the way that post-war society has developed. So it's very strongly after the war. Sure.
And frankly, those details of post-war society are better in that book than the mystery is. Mm. But when the war was going on, she did not touch it. And it's fascinating to me that in 1944, these people can be hanging out at Gull's Point and not thinking about what's going on at all outside. I think that adds a sort of fantastical element to this, sort of an out of this world quality. But there's some of that in Toward Zero.
I think, though, that it's not set during the war. I mean, she's setting it 5 years ago so that she can do that, isn't she? But people writing novels now who've decided they're just not going to put COVID in, because if they set the novel a year ago, 2 years ago, they have to put COVID in. So they just make it late 2010s, you know, 2015, 2016.
Even if it's taking place in 1939, Britain was very aware of what was going on over in Germany, weren't they? I mean, there was...
Well before 1939, good heavens. Yeah, well and truly, well before 1939. It doesn't even have to be 1939.
A lot of people see a great deal of the war in And Then There Were None, which was published that year and therefore must have been written before, but that there's a certain element of that, of the emotions of war and the emotions of that kind of, that, well, we won't go into that here, but that you see elements of the war in that 1939 novel. Mm. Do not see it here. And that I obviously a clear choice. Let's just focus on a lovely mystery in a lovely part of England.
Yep.
And be done with it.
I think she made a conscious decision. I mean, to the extent of setting one in ancient Egypt rather than looking at
that's her next
local
book.
Happenings. Yeah. 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 I think she just decided. And I don't think she was alone. I think there were a lot of novels produced during the war, which because that's what some people would have wanted, a bit of a comfort read. They don't want to read about the war. They're in the middle of it. So let's go back. Let's read about Country House Parties in 1937.
Well, which is why I find Green for Danger so compelling and so different.
Couldn't be more opposite.
Couldn't be more different, because it is forcing you to look at the war and what the war could do to people, because every element of it is tied in with what's going on in England at that moment. So just wanted to mention that.
And it's very much all those people would not be there. They would not be in that place if it weren't for the war, one way or another.
Right. And the murder wouldn't happen without the war. I mean, there's so much about that. But we'll get to that when we do our Christiana Brand spoiler warning podcasts.
In 50 years' time, after we've finished Agatha Christie.
Right. Well, in 2075.
On that note, next Agatha Christie spoiler warning is Mrs. McGinty's Dead sometime in October, I think. This is going up in July. So yeah, so the next one will be 3 months' time in October. That might be the final one. I find editing these really tedious. I love having the conversations, and I'm just finding the editing of it just a little bit hard work. So if it ends in October, it'll be entirely my fault. And that might be it. Unless I can find a way to make it either earn me some money, or I can find a way for Brad to edit them for me. So if anybody has any suggestions, let me know.
Yes, either if people would put in the comments section either how to teach Brad how to do technology, or they will offer free editing to us to help us continue this for the next 60 books.
I don't think I'd want to impose the unedited versions of these audio files on anybody. I think our stock would fall. All of Brad's swearing, for a start, would come out. And I don't think the world's ready for that. I just don't
right,
think
right, and JJ drools through the whole thing. We have to stop.
I suppose you're going to say you don't like my singing now, aren't you? But when I...
Singing. We'll talk about singing.
You broke up then. I didn't catch what you said. Okay, so ever so swiftly, let's bring this to an end. Thank you, guys. Always fun. Always lovely.
Yes.
And we will see you both in 3 months for... What did I say? Mrs. McGinty's
dead.
It is Mrs. McGinty's dead. Beautiful. Well, thank you both again for putting up with my drooling. And see
you soon. It was a pleasure.
It was great.
All right. Bye-bye.